Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Limewire Technical Net. The Limewire Technical Net has been going strong for more than 40 years, mostly under the guidance of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent T a few years ago. And so we continue this technical net in his memory and as a method of us all learning more things together. Each of us knows different things that we can share with each other, and I hope you all had time to come by this Sunday night where we could try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual link. Okay. If you need to reach me via email, that would be either to ask questions that you can't ask during the net, all those mailbag questions, and they used to be very popular once upon a time, or if there are topics you would like to either do a little presentation on, or be part of a presentation, or part of a discussion, or just hear discussed. Also, we are always searching for puzzles to interest people and expand our neuron capabilities and such, remember things that we forgot, learn things we never learned. So if you have any kind of technical-based puzzles, usually things that aren't very easily Googled, please send it to me. Or if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at a space or an NASA-related story and report back on it, my email address is mailbag@cc2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, Paul has an email address as well. It's the spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a link page with all kinds of interesting articles and YouTube that I've come across in the last week that I thought I'd share with you. That's on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. You just type that into your browser and you get those links. They're open 24/7. So any old time you have nothing better to do, type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com and take a look at the articles. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's very busy, sometimes it's very quiet. The best way to get to it is to go into your browser and once again type in chat.ac2gs.com and that'll bring you to our chat room. We have an audio stream for people who don't have access any other method of listening to us. Tonight, unfortunately, Echo Link is down. So for the people who usually listen on Echo Link, hopefully they will use our audio stream, which is available by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people of MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site called AmateurRadio.tv, where he has archives of the Limewire Technical Net going as far back as December of 2006. Has over a million visitors, and add to it. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay, we will start the net in the usual manner, asking people if they have any technical questions, preferably related to amateur radio at the very beginning. Topics for discussion, what have you, as time goes on, we'll open it up, and any aspects of science and technology, certainly available to ask the question. I'll try my best to come up with something as an answer, and I'm sure other people listening will help as well. As always, we do not treat nor diagnose over the radio, but if you want to discuss generalized medical concepts, I'll take it on as much as any other scientific topic. We do have tonight a short presentation from Ed, WB2EAB. He will be discussing I and Q signals. Those are in-phase and quadrature delayed signals. I believe Jeff, AC2PL, requested that a few weeks ago, and Ed was kind enough to offer his services, so I'm looking forward to that. I do have a little teeny-tiny itsy-bitsy puzzle, or just an interesting thing that came across my view screen in the last week that I will hopefully bring up before the night ends. That should take us to approximately 10:15. Paul will come and give us the SpaceNet report until about 11 o'clock. I'll return and wish you all a good week and close the net. That's the plan, if the universe allows me. So, as in most episodes of the Limark Technical Met, I now ask anyone who has a question or a topic for discussion tonight, please hit that push-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
KG2RY, good evening.
David recognized. Anyone else want to check in with any questions or topics for tonight? Okay, maybe the rest of the people with questions will, you know, think them up or come to the radio a little bit later. It's been a very hot day. I hope everyone has air conditioning and a cold drink in front of them. So, David, what's your question or your comment for tonight?
Well, my comment question is about digital ham radio. I had some problems with my Anytone 878UV. For some reason, the transmitter wasn't putting out signal. So I called the company, and they walked me through several steps to decorrupt the software and the hardware inside the radio. And it didn't work. So I decided I would go back to my old MD-380. Yeah, I would go back to my MD-380 and reprogram that. So I got a programming cable, and I downloaded the software, and I was able to get the results that I wanted. The MD-380 is a great little radio, and much easier to hold down the PTT button for sure. And doesn't sound great, but, you know, it's still a good radio. And so I was able to get the results that I wanted, you know, to put one channel into Time Slot 2, static talk group, Time Slot 2, and then one in Time Slot 1. So I'm monitoring. If you want to get first-hand information about some place, you can find it. Sit and listen, and if you're patient enough, you know, you can talk to somebody who can give you that information. It's not hard to find. That, and also on D-Star. So, tremendous success with the digital ham radio. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm sad to hear that your Anytone 387 has failed you. I assume it's that Bridge Communications company that you contacted, because I don't know if Anytone itself has that much of a technical debt to talk to. And sometimes if you're lucky, as you mentioned, it could be corruption of the firmware, and you could reset it to factory settings and bring it back. Unfortunately, sometimes it's a hardware problem where all the software reboots in the world aren't going to fix it. But I am glad that you still have your MD-380. I kind of amazingly have the same pair of handy talkies. In this room, I have an MD-380. In another room in the house, I have an Anytone 878. Both of them are very good for what they are. The MD-380 is a much lighter, smaller radio, but it's a monobander, and the audio is not quite as punchy, but very useful, and especially if you're going to use it for things like hotspots, you don't really need a dual band. Monoband will probably suffice. And I agree with you that if you take enough time and effort, the digital voice modes are networked through the internet and offer you a lot of either talk groups or rooms or reflectors that can at times be full of very clever, smart people with all kinds of answers. As in most cases, you always need a trusty BS meter. Occasionally, you might bump into a guy who has somewhat delusions of grandeur and thinks he knows more than he does know. But, you know, as long as you have a well-calibrated BS meter, the digital talk-through room reflectors are an excellent source of information.
Well, the company that sold me the AGD-878UV, that sold it to me, and later on, I asked them, can you repair the radio? I'll pay, you know, if it's not too expensive. They said, no, we don't repair radios that are out of warranty. So they said, why don't you just buy a new one? I said, well, that's a nice suggestion.
Well, that goes back, let me just see if I have the repeater. Okay, that goes back to our disposable economy. It's getting worse and worse and more in that direction, that it simply isn't cost effective. Now, in the case of this particular model, a lot of times these people are just not capable of replacing surface mount components. A lot of these people, what they do is initially when they sell a large contingent, they also get spare parts. And they'll pull out a PC board and pop in a replacement. And their technical staff is kind of based upon that concept, the idea of finding the errant surface mount device, desoldering it, and replacing the part is probably way beyond them. And a lot of times I've read emails of companies who are in this U.S. distribution market complain that they're not getting spare parts as much as they used to. So it's probably more akin to the fact that they simply don't have spare PC boards, and they're not really built to do nitty-gritty surface mount replacements that you would hope that they would be able to do.
Well, they gave me the name of a repair shop, you know, and I said, what an odd repair shop. Look at it on the internet, and the page, you know, it's like one of those, how to say, pages that are very unsophisticated, said, do I trust? Send it to this place, and then they're going to tell me how much it costs. So I think that the company, Bridgecom, the company, they offered me a refurbished 878 at a reduced price. I said, no, I'm going to try to get my MD380 up and running. You know, it's only for the hotspot. It's not for outside. I'm not going to call repeaters with it, you know.
Okay, and you know that certainly is an option. It's, you know, they're a business; they're trying to make money. And as far as websites and such, unfortunately, sometimes it's a reflection of a shady business. A lot of times, though, it's a reflection of someone who may be very adept at fixing radio circuits and might even be adept at surface mount replacements. But not really in this particular century when it comes to web design. So they might have clubbed it themselves. They might have handed it over to a nephew or a grandson. And so you still kind of see these very unusual websites that look like they belong in something like 1995, 96, with animated GIFs and scrolling numbers and jumping things all over the place. It's a very classic design. So it's probably a flashing, a flashing yellow light. But the reality of things is that there might be guys who are incredibly adept at RF circuit repair and don't have the faintest idea what HTML code is.
Yeah. I think it might be better if I call Bridgecom tomorrow and ask them if they'll give me money on my old HD, I can send it in. And then that would sort of go against the cost of a refurbished one. I don't know if it's even worth that much trouble.
Well, I don't know. You can certainly ask them. They might be amenable. They might tell you how much they can give you off of the price of the refurbished radio. Again, it kind of calls back to the status of repair parts. You know, if they're sitting there with a couple of dozen boxes of replacement PCs, they would be much more amenable to it rather than if they're down to their last half a box and they have to hold on to them for the sake of people who are still in warranty. Although I like the MD-380, I did have a little problem with the MD-380. Display is attached with a ribbon cable that can be very iffy, so I had to disassemble it and reinsert the display control ribbon in order to get the display back. So, and you know, I'm sure there would be some people who would do it without a second thought, and other people that would just chuck it into the garbage in our disposable society. But it's a good radio. I like it. I use it. But I have had some small problems with it in the past.
QSL. Well, I lucked out with my MD-380. It works great. Never a problem with it. Even programming it went pretty smoothly, you know, from 878 to MD-3. And what to say, you know, I tried to change the firmware. I changed the firmware in the 878. And then what else did I have to do? I had to export all the data and then import the data again. So, yeah, you export the data, then you change the firmware, then you import the data, then you put it in the radio. I think that was it. And then what else did they say I had to do?
This is the 878 you're talking about, not the 380?
Yeah, the 878. To decorrupt the hardware and software inside. But once I went through that whole process, you know, with the programming cable and the software, I tried it, didn't work. Same problem as before, that the transmit signal, you know, it wasn't, how to say, it wasn't aligning with the hotspot. Although MD-380 was working fine, so, you know, I suspect, you know, there were problems with the 878 long before I even tried to use it again. For that signals would just drop out, you know, when I was using repeater, analog and digital, and I now think that the problem was very long-term.
Yeah, it could be. Sometimes these things can start intermittently, or especially if you don't use a piece of hardware often and you kind of accept its foibles. In a easier world, it would be simply a firmware corruption, because it's a lot easier to reset the firmware than it is to fix a component failure. So they were kind of giving you the best case scenario of a way that you can personally fix it. If it's software or firmware, it's fixable without taking out a desoldering iron. If it's a discrete component that has failed over time, which is possible, then, you know, all the software in the world isn't going to go around that. So, you gave it a good try. I never had that many problems with the 878. I've updated firmware a few times. I've never really found it to be that terribly useful, the new firmware. A lot of it is more cosmetic than anything else. So I haven't done it recently. upgrading the CPS software, which is the software that one used to generate a data plug for the channels and zones and talk groups and such for repeaters. Sometimes they change the nature of the files, so that's when you have to start doing the import and export trick when you're upgrading to a newer CPS software. But it's doable. I find Bridgecom to be a very good company in many ways. They're a little annoying when it comes to email. I get email from them almost every single day, and it's kind of difficult, other than putting it in my spam file, to slow down the pace. They're promoting everything possible, but they do have a lot of videos. They answer a lot of questions. I see that YouTube has something from them almost every other day, answering questions about DMR technology, how to program a DMR radio, and how to program a hotspot, and all kinds of useful things. So, they're a very effective company. As far as I know, they stand behind their products for the nature of the warranty. But, you know, all warranties expire, even the best products. Wish you good luck with that.
82AMZ, for quick comment.
Yes, AMZ.
Well, thank you. Well, first of all, any tone is a half a step above and or equal to Bofang. It's manufactured in China by Zaigan Electron Science and Technology. So it's a Chinese company, and anyone who makes a Chinese HC, we know where that comes from. And the tech service people are located in Arlington, South Dakota. Arlington, South Dakota. So good luck reaching South Dakota. But Brickson, they're just the middleman sales. Good luck. Stick to Motorola. You're better off.
Well, Mike, that certainly is a good Buy American philosophy. The reality is that Motorola is not easy to program. You either have to purchase a license, or have a friend who purchased a license, or had a license fall off a truck someplace. And the instructions for that software can be somewhat esoteric. They're built like bricks. They are much more expensive than any tone I can think of. And I think it doesn't do a service to say simply that it's a Chinese radio, so it's like a Baofeng. Because my iPhone is manufactured in China as well, and it's a rather sophisticated. It was designed in the United States, but it was built in China. And I find any tones to be a couple of levels up above Baofeng. Baofengs are pleasant, inexpensive, disposable radios. They go for about $35, which is something like 1/8 the price of an Anytone 878. You pick up an Anytone 878, there's a heft to it. It's not as simple as a little chip on a radio on a chip type of thing. So for people who want to buy American, that's great. I'm all for that. The problem is that American manufacturers don't manufacture that many things in America anymore. I give you, once again, Apple. Their stuff is manufactured, as far as I'm aware, in Shenzhen, China. They have great quality control, and they use very sophisticated design and components. But they are Chinese manufactured cell phones.
Keyword, manufactured and quality control. Google QIXIANG Electron Science. See what kind of reviews you got. Sorry, I can't accept it. It's basically Chinese trash. But anyways, your money, your decision, you do what you gotta do.
And I think I like stuff Japanese made. It's all really based on preference. There's no right or wrong answer. Also, would like to be added to the standby list.
Okay, Craig, consider yourself added. Different people like different things. You could make a similar case saying that I would rather have an American-made radio than a Japanese-made radio, because all the Japanese make wonderful equipment, and, you know, they're a democratic, relatively upstanding country, as opposed to other countries, you know, by America. My Flex, gotta love it. It's built in Texas, which is about as American as most Texans ever want to get. So, yeah, it depends on the individual. You could certainly hold the belief that your DMRs should be Motorola. If you go on any talk group, you will end up endlessly listening to guys who are mostly using Anytone, usually the 878, sometimes the 868. The second favorite group of DMR radios on talk group is probably the MD-380. So most talk groups are populated by these relatively less expensive Chinese radios. Again, one of my big problems with Motorola radios is you basically either have to have a license, which can cost hundreds if not thousands of dollars, a friend who has a license, or you're kind of offending the rules with a license that someone found someplace, you know, in a ditch somewhere. So, you know, every so often you'll find an email list, a guy asking if anyone has access to a Motorola programming software so that he could put in talk group to his Motorola DMR.
Most DMRs, sorry, most Motorolas, I thought you couldn't really see what you could see what you're programming in, and it's kind of like blindly programming a radio, because I've seen Motorolas that are preset that only have like six models on it.
Well, my understanding is there are certainly different models of Motorola, but Motorola's philosophy is significantly different than the DMRs that most amateur radio operators use. They were designed initially to be a commercial product. The idea was not that you'd give a handy talkie to your employee and he'd go home and program it, but you'd have a guy that you pay X number of bucks a week to sit there with the licensed software that you paid X number of bucks a year, and they would do all the programming. So for the most part, Motorola's radios are not all field programmable. Some are, some aren't. And again, the software is under a license. You can't just download it someplace. You need to either pay a license or, again, do something a little bit less than legal. With the case of the Chinese manufactured radios, they all supply what's called CPS software, which is the programming software for that particular DMR radio. They're all written in rather bad Visual Basic. The sorting algorithms are circa 1998. They run slow as molasses. Getting things done with them is a little annoying at times, but it works, and it's a lot cheaper. So whatever one likes. It's a free country. If you want to stay American and buy Motorola, then God bless you. If you like Japanese, there's not really much choice in DMR radios in from Japan, unless you buy a company that's based in Japan that has it manufactured in China again. So, again, in my experiences on talk groups and such, the overwhelming majority are using Anytone 878, 868, or the MD-380.
I still have my 2017 one someplace. I gotta look for it. Never bothered really trying DMR. It wasn't really my thing. I mean, I wanted to, but then I suddenly just launched and searched in it. I mean, the only Japanese radio I have, which I'm using, is my Icon V82. I would like something American made at some point. They're just so darn expensive. I mean, that's why I typically just stick with my 5Rs. One bow thing that I tried using that I would like to maybe get again and give it another go was the UV-82. It's a little bit different because there's not many buttons, and you have to hold in a button while turning it on to get it to go to the right mode, and for some reason it was not doing that to me, so I ended up sending it back. So...
Okay, well, that's a that's a Chinese radio as well. The problem, among other things, is that at this point, DMR radios made in the United States are not really designed, per se, for amateurs in mind. Again, it's Motorola, and they're designing it for corporate entities. So they have different budgets and different price points. So it's very expensive. You're not going to really find, as far as I'm aware, any truly amateur radio handy talkies made in the United States. They're all rebranded commercial products. You will find HF radios that are designed and built in the United States, the Flex, and there's a few other companies that are still manufacturing in the United States. Most of the radios that most amateurs have, not counting the cheaper Chinese ones, are the Japanese. They have been very successful in sort of taking over the entire industry. Kenwood, Yaesu, and ICOM probably make up a significant portion of all radios that are sold in the United States. Again, with the exception of less expensive Chinese handy-talkies.
Yeah, but in my case, I didn't want to spend any money, you know? I realized that the little radios that I have can do the job. And so I can spend my money on food or something else.
Okay, that's a great idea. Food is a heck of a lot more important than a radio. You know, it might get me stringed up to say that, but it's true. You know, we all have to kind of decide what we can afford and what we can't afford and whether we can afford to give ourselves overpriced presents or not. Amateur radio operators as a group are less loose with their wallets than a lot of other hobbies. There's a lot of hobbies out there. We touched upon it a month or two ago, serial files, you know, guys who are into high fidelity sound. You'll find a lot more people willing to throw a lot more dollars at that hobby than amateur radio. A lot of amateur radio operators prefer using older equipment, using equipment that they've had for many years, mending things rather than throwing them out. So it's a little bit more problematic making a profit off of this industry than some other hobbies might be. So I understand entirely. And, you know, if the MD-380 does what you need it to do, which sounds like it does, then great. And, you know, you never know. In 5 or 6 years, there might be some kind of technological breakthrough with some radio design that will add a bunch of new features that at the time will be important to you. And if the price is right, you might invest in that down the road.
Yeah, for me, that's the challenge. In any case of, you know, electronics, you know, stereo systems, I even own a CRT TV, and it works great. I just picked up a VHS VCR because I had some tapes I wanted to watch.
Okay, you know, there are people out there with that. I've kind of cycled through technologies in an unfortunately kind of disappointed way. I used to endlessly joke about, I was a big Star Trek fan before they kind of ruined it lately. So I had the Star Trek in VHS tape. I had the Star Trek in Laserdisc. The Laserdisc was a thing that was very nice when it was there. And then it faded, and then I had DVDs. So I kind of split up, and unfortunately, the mechanics are the first things to go with things. And so mechanical devices from the 1980s are somewhat difficult to maintain, and eventually they fail. Then you have to decide whether you're going to buy a new in box from 20 years ago, or what you're going to do. I mean, Yeah, there are occasionally older technologies that are still being manufactured. Turntables are still a thing that are being manufactured, but I would assume that most VCRs are kind of new in box, like some vacuum tubes are. But, you know, you're free to use the old technology. It's always amused me when people discuss the time, the longevity of a certain medium, making the assumption that methods of turning it back into whatever, you know, you want to watch or something are always going to be there. It's not necessarily the case. I mean, a CD might last 1,000 years, but if there's no CD players to play them on, there's not much you can do except to use them as frisbees.
USO. And I have to say that my LPs, they sound fantastic. MP3s from a computer, they sound flat. I don't play my CDs on a CD player. I download them into a playlist program, I guess, called Music Now, but it was called iTunes 4. And how to say, you know, how do you get the quality? MP3s are newer than LPs. And LPs sound a million times better. CDs even sound better than MP3s. And if you listen for streaming, FLAC streaming, it's almost CD quality, but it sounds pretty good.
Well, it's not a case of digital versus not digital in many cases. It's your preference to compression artifacts. MP3 was a rather early, lossy compression artifact. CDs had raw bit streams, and they had WAV files, so there was no loss. It was everything that was digitized was transferred to a WAV file and placed on a CD. It took up too much space, in people's opinion, and so they went for different lossy algorithms that used clever tricks to trick the ears and the brain into accepting a much lower resolution sound. As some people have bad hearing to begin with and have no aesthetics, and a highly compressed MP3 file sounds great to them, especially if you give them a lot of bass and nothing else. Other people have a better tuned ear, and you need a higher bitstream rate, and you need a much more clever algorithm, which you mentioned, FLAC, is a much higher fidelity compression algorithm. So it's not the digital versus analog so much as it is the tricks that one tries to play with compressing a digital stream to the smallest possible space, especially in the old days when memory was very much more expensive than it is today.
Yeah, CDs, they're compressed. CDs are compressed audio. Take it off of the tape. The difference between the tape and the CD is monumental. You know, if you look around on the internet, you can get HD digital audio. Maybe 192 kilohertz, 24-bit audio, which is way better than a CD. But you can get even more resolution than that, you know, if you look around for it. I just don't know what is available at that resolution.
It's not that CDs are compressed, because if you look at them, they're all in WAV files. WAV is not a compression algorithm. WAV is a simple bit stream. What you're seeing is the bit rate. It was up to the person transcoding the analog audio of what is the bit rate for the analog to digital conversion. Obviously, if you set the bit rate very, very low, you get a small file, but the resolution of the dynamic range is terrible, and the fidelity is awful, because you basically have to have a bit rate that's twice the highest frequency that you want to, with any kind of fidelity, reproduce. So the only real thing you could do with a WAV file was change the bit stream. The higher the bit stream, the higher the frequency range that you could capture. But it's not really true compression. It was after the WAVE files were promulgated that everyone decided they needed lossy compression, where they take into consideration how people's ears and brains perceive sound. In the same sort of way that Dolby kind of tricked you into not hearing as much noise as you did by manipulating the source. MP3s, and there were a series of compression algorithms. There are a lot of video compression algorithms that are incredibly effective. If you had to record the raw bit stream of a digital signal like YouTube or any of the streaming services, you would clog up your internet provider almost immediately.
Yeah. CDs have a limitation compared to HD digital audio. You take the source and you transfer it onto digital hard drive. The capture, you know, from tape to HD digital audio or from tape to CD audio. And the result is HD digital audio will just blow away a CD. And I think they're both WAVE files.
2STP.
Yes, Chris, recognize. I just want to point out that raw files simply mean that they're not using algorithms to compress them. But again, there's a very important dynamic range and bit stream rate, sampling rate, is very important in the digitizing of any analog signal and is not considered part of an intelligent compression algorithm. But Chris, what would you like to say?
It's Chris, KQSUP. Thanks, Roy. CDs, to that gentleman, are actually a much higher bit rate than you think. I thought they were in the 600 or 700 range by memory. I just looked online. They're 1,000. So they're actually very high. That's not what's killing the sound quality. It's what Roy was referring to, more of the range that they use when they burn them, or, you know, how they record them. The recordings are usually good, but they lower the sound quality. And the reason some of those digital audios sound better is because they are using compression, and the compression is making the very high highs higher and the very low lows lower, and it's usually the lows that make you think it sounds better. And they're doing that digitally. It's actually not the recording. So it's a little...
Yeah, but the dynamic range, HD digital audio, has much more space in it for audio signal. And, of course, the HD digital audio is much larger size file because it has more information in it. And, you know, CD grade, you know, can get just okay. If you've listened to HD digital audio and had experience with it, then maybe you would have a different idea about it.
I've got some experience. Some friends of mine are in the audio industry, so they record bands and whatnot, but I'm not a specialist in it. But I do know that they play with the audio on the digital recordings, and they can make it sound much better than even an album, because the compression they use, they call it a compressor. I don't quite understand the difference. Maybe Roy knows that, what the difference of a digital compressor is compared to compression. Compression generally refers to compressing the data so it's a smaller file, so it fits on something. And you do lose quality that way, but they use compressors prior to digitizing it, and it makes it sound much better than the actual recording.
Barry Master them for the limitation of the medium. Medium only has so much space for digital data to, you know, for it to hold. So, of course, a standard limitation for all CDs, and you would master them differently for HD digital audio. And the clarity, you know, the qualities, how could I say?
Okay, we seem to have a pause. This is AT2GS. Let me just check that I have the repeater. Okay. Chris was mentioning a couple of things. We were talking about compression of files. David was mentioning, up until very recently, memory space was rather expensive. You know, nowadays you could theoretically get a micro SD card that's a terabyte, which I could not begin to imagine back in the days when they were selling 2 megabyte hard drives that cost $2,000. But nevertheless, compression is simply a way of compressing the total data content. In some cases, if you're lucky, you can do lossless compression. If you are operating on files that have repeated patterns, you could then encode those repeated patterns, and every time the same repeated pattern occurred, you could have a lookup table. So that's a lossless compression algorithm. What we're familiar mostly with is lossy compression algorithms that throw out data. Just throw it out because they have kind of clever algorithms that understand what people can detect and what they can't. And anything that a human being can't detect isn't worth keeping, so they dump it out, and that frees space as well. Also, Chris was talking about compressors. There's a lot of audio gadgets out there. Two are compressors and expanders. A compressor will take a dynamic range of an audio signal and squeeze it down to a lower level. The lows will be a little higher, the highs will be a little lower. You used to see that with television commercials. You would watch something quietly show, and then all of a sudden the commercial would zoom at you because they had put a compressor on the audio stream. There's also an expander, which does the exact opposite. It increases the dynamic range for a given signal artificially. It tries to do it smartly. Sometimes it's clever and can do it, and sometimes it's not too clever.
Absolutely agreed, Roy. And the compressor and expander, they're very careful in using them on recordings like a CD because, from what I remember them mentioning to me, because I say to them, hey, why don't you always make it sound that way? They're afraid if they put too much on a CD for the listener, because the CD can handle it, but very often people have cheap stereos, as we all know, and cheap speakers, and if they put that kind of range or dynamic range on the audio on a CD, most people, it'll sound horrible because it'll clip and make their speakers and audio system sound poorly. So they take a lot of that out for that reason. It's actually not the CD quality problem. It's how they're releasing their music, I guess.
You know, software, software package, the entire catalog of the Beatles, plus an HD audio. He said, you know, we have to try to avoid the death of music. You know, the music has deteriorated in quality to 30 years ago. People just
great so that on rare occasion when it needs that you have an amplifier that's capable of dealing with it rather than a
quality
with it. So that's the problem with an underpowered sound system. If you have
it doesn't sound good because you end up with distortion at the high dynamic range. And so most music producers tend to kind of design their stuff for a sort of average group of people, not people who have monoblocks and 1,000-watt amplifiers for each channel and such.
Well, you know, there was this singer. His name is Neil Young. He invented a hardware-software player. with the entire Beatles catalog in HD digital audio. He said that it is his quest to save the music.
Okay, and that's a good idea. I don't know if it's a financially great investment idea, because most people, unfortunately, do not have great ears when it comes to music. They tolerate heavily compressed music. But for people either with great ears or delusions that they have great ears, that is certainly a viable product. You know, I wouldn't invest a lot of money in a company that did that, because unfortunately, I assume that most people wouldn't be interested in paying the overhead that generally costs them.
Well, you know, you want to preserve the quality of the tape, and you have to do it with a fat audio file, and a capture of a fat audio file from the original tape. The full resolution of the audio, and you know, I kind of like that. I think maybe it's not for everyone.
Yeah, I tend to not think it's really designed ultimately for archiving, because people who are going to archive their tapes are going to archive the originals. So if for some odd reason they're using analog still to record, they'll have the analog tapes, but for the most part, they'll have these big, massive copies of these big, massive hard drives full of bit streams of uncompressed source, and they'll put it in a secure vault, again with multiple copies, depending upon your degree of paranoia. I don't think major publishing companies are going to default to Neil Young's high fidelity algorithm as the ultimate archive of their source material.
That, and each audio file is at least 100, 200, 300 megabits size, so you have an album that is maybe 1.2, 1.3, 1.4 gigabits. Am I right?
Yeah, but today that doesn't mean anything. If you would have said this back in 1990, people would kind of think that you lived in another universe, because you would be talking about a large, you know, CDs could only store 700 megabytes total. Nowadays, you couldn't even buy a thumb drive with that low a capacity. I think the lowest capacity thumb drive I've seen recently is something like 4 or 8 gigabytes. You might be able to pick up a used USB that's smaller, but you know, nowadays chip design is such that one chip will do that. So it's not a problem now. It was an enormous problem back in the days. You know, I remember my first computer had a 48,000-bit memory total. That was it. You know, nowadays, it's 64 gigabits. So we've gone a far way.
Well, there are websites that offer downloads of, you know, certain musical material you can buy as large as 384 kilobit, 32-bit, 384 kilohertz, 32-bit audio. You can listen to it and capture it directly from the tape. They're kind of pricey. You can get them, though.
Yeah, I mean, if you have access to the original archive, you can digitize them to any bit rate that you could possibly want. There's not a great deal of limitation with analog to digital conversion. Many, many years ago, I was chatting with Dick, K2RIW, about my FDR, And at that time, he kind of questioned whether running my SDR for all that bitstream conversion, he asked me, why isn't my radio melting? Because silicon has gotten progressively better and is capable of massive analog-to-digital conversion. So you can pretty much set the bitstream rate and the dynamic range that you want and fill up any hard drive or solid-state drive that you want with a single audio stream. It probably is incredibly excessive and doesn't add, you get a degree of diminishing return. But the hardware has allowed us complete freedom of choosing whatever you want. I mean, the reason why you're not going to see anything more than a 384 or something thousand cycle per second sampling stream, is simply because most of the hardware that people have isn't capable of dealing with more than that. So that's the kind of a soft level of stopping at that point. But there's nothing inherent in the silicon design. You could have a higher sampling rate if you wanted to. Just couldn't use it on any hardware that the average person owns.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's ways to do all these different things. And there are machines that will do that. And I personally like to listen to my CDs from my computer, so I put them into a playlist and I connect through USB to audio interface, and from audio interface into the stereo preamplifier to the amplifier, and then through the loudspeakers. And the quality is, you know, it's pretty good for CDs. And what to say, you know, it runs off of an external hard drive, and it plays really good. And I guess, you know, it's about as good as it gets, although, you know, I think my LPs sound much better.
Well, but you have to be more accepting of the clicking and the other artifacts, because I went through LPs just like you, and I had my special anti-static brush and my magical distilled water to apply to clean the dust out of the grooves, and they still had clicks and pops, and if you didn't take proper care of them, they jumped, so they had their own foibles. You know, going way back, anytime a technology changes, immediately the benefit is very questionable, because almost always you have to kind of shift the way that you do things in order to maximize people's enjoyment of the experience. And it was the same with digital sound. When digital sound first came on, there were a lot of complaints of the harshness of the source material. And over a few years, the audio engineers figured out how to present the digital sound in a more pleasing way. You get that even in digital television. There was an early time when the higher resolution digital television broadcast started. The makeup people and the cameramen weren't quite ready for it. There were a lot of not pleasant looking artifacts visible on early digital broadcasts. And so they redesigned makeup, and they redesigned some aspects of how you modify the video signal, and all's well with the world. So, you know, there'll always be people who want to stay in an analog world, and there'll always be people who always want to be in a digital world, and then there's the rest of us who are somewhere in between.
KG2RY. Well, you know, when you say all of this, you know, that the new technology comes, and then there's a commercial, an endless barrage of commercials, like the Bridgecom. You were saying that Bridgecom, they make lots of videos, you know, to teach people how to use their products. But those are also endless stream of commercials everywhere. You want to buy something. You need to buy something. Like the MD380, I didn't want to buy another 878. I didn't want to spend the money, you know, and can I get the MD-380 to do what it needs to do, you know. And, you know, even like going through the internet and on television and even walking down the street, endless stream of commercials you want to buy.
We live in a capitalist society. Let me drop and see if I got the repeater.